Palfrey, wheel 8. Can you tell me what happened in the aftermath of that attack?
Well, yes, I can complete the little bit I was doing and then tell you what we did. The Chinese pilot who had disappeared from the bridge, a second message was broadcast. A search is to be made for the Chinese pilot and he is to be brought to the bridge. Well, anyway, he refused to go back to the bridge. In the meantime, his opposite number, the other pilot, had been wounded and he was killed. So that there was no one other than the officer of the watch who would have been in a position to deal with the navigation side of life, quite apart from the damage and the casualties that there were. So the ship was turned around and went back down the river. And we then stopped at Kaing Yin, the naval base again. The consort, the destroyer consort, which had been in Nanking, had already left Nanking before we got anywhere near, and she had been shelled, and she had had 10 sailors killed and I think 15 injured. But she wasn't as able to assist the Amethyst. She came down the river and tied up alongside the London, and we took on board all the casualties from the consort, and then she went on to Shanghai, I think, and I think she disembarked the dead sailors in Shanghai. But we had then the casualties from London, the casualties from consort, and the Black Swan had, I think, 2 or 3 casualties, and they also were brought on board. Fortunately for us, there was an American hospital ship not too far away. On hearing about the emergency and the incident, she approached, and I can't say how long it was, but she came nearby and took on board.
Right.
Yes, the USS Repose, fortunately, came alongside and took on board all the casualties and then left the area, and she looked after them. I believe 2 or 3 of those who were wounded died on board the American ship, but the remainder were looked after very well indeed. The consort, as I say, had been alongside and she had gone. And then, after that, we returned to the area of Shanghai, but we didn't go into Shanghai then. We went out to Alacrity Anchorage, which was about 70 miles from Shanghai, at a place called Wusong, which is at the bottom end of the river Yangtze. There are enormous forts. Fortunately, they weren't in a firing mood at us. I don't know who was manning them at the time, but it appears the communists had not arrived that far. We went anyway to Alacrity Anchorage and stayed there for, I think, about 3 weeks. Again, dealing with all the signal traffic. Our relief had arrived there from the Atlantic, HMS Jamaica. She had come and she took over the duties that we had been doing in that area. And HMS Belfast also came. And as far as the Yangtze incident was concerned, as far as we were concerned, apart from the communication fallout, it was over, and the casualties and so forth. But of course, the Amethyst was left up the river for a total of 3 months. But all this happened in such the actual firing part of it, the action itself, lasted for such a short time. This is one of the things about naval warfare. Hours, days, months go by and it's waiting and watching and waiting and watching. But when there is some action, it seems to take place usually in a very short term.
What happened to you and to HMS London after that?
Well, as I said, after the incident, and London went to Singapore, I had some leave, then I had a week in the headquarters there, then I returned to London. London was still getting some signals at that stage, but the story really ended when the Amethyst escaped. But then the London stayed in the Singapore area for some time, because she in fact was a useless ship. Although we had guns, they weren't fireable because of the circuits had been all damaged. It was said that the cost of repairing the electrics alone in those days would have been something like £2 million. How far that is true, I don't know, but that was the figure quoted. The ship remained out there, and we came home sometime in August, and we arrived in Chatham, I think it was, in September, when the 13 West countrymen were bundled on a train as soon as the ship arrived, and that was the last we heard from London or of London, until we learned that the ship was being given the freedom of London, marching through London and being entertained at a banquet at the Lord Mayor's Mansion House in London. We didn't get any invitations to that. We did get an invitation to go to a memorial service for the crew of the Amethyst in HMS Drake, the West Country depot, when the ship actually returned. I went to that. But the only thing I know now about HMS London is that there have been other HMS Londons, and there is an HMS London Association of which I'm a member. And I've been to two of their reunions, one in Portsmouth, and one with all four ships involved in Plymouth. That was to mark the 50th anniversary. The one this year is the 60th anniversary. But I won't be going to that because I believe it's in the Midlands or Chatham.
You've been away from the UK for some time when you returned.
Yes, I had been away a long time. But I wasn't married in them those days. And I was given the offer of having my leave. I had 92 days leave, I think, when I returned. But before I returned, I was actually given the offer by the Fleet Communication Officer, Commander Williams, who invited me to go home, have my leave, enjoy it, and come back out and rejoin the staff. And he hinted that it would be to my benefit. But I'd had enough of the Far East at that time, and so I didn't undertake to do as he requested.
Did you do after you'd taken leave?
Well, I went back in September the 9th actually, I went back to HMS Drake, and I was there until the end of 20th of December. I was assigned to the maintenance commander's office in the dockyard in Devonport. There was a chief yeoman as the leader and four yeomen, working in that office. And we were responsible for running the boat routines in the harbour, arranging for funerals at the Western Mill Cemetery for ex-sailors, arranging train journeys for people going on draft to Scotland, Ireland, or wherever they were going, arranging bag meals for them at crew. An absolutely fascinating job, but it had nothing to do with communications. I enjoyed it nevertheless. I was in Diggs in Devonport with a lovely family. They looked after me very well. And it was at that time that I got married.
You say you were in Diggs. Is that quite common for sailors to be?
Oh, it was very common at that time because there was a shortage of accommodation. This happened in a number of establishments. I came to HMS Mercury on one occasion and was straight away sent out to Petersfield to find somewhere to live, for which one got an allowance. But that was quite commonplace. But that's what happened. I lived in Diggs. I was on what they called ration allowance, which was a favourite means of living in those days because it meant that you could have the freedom of living outside of the barracks and just report for duty during the day. And while I was there, there was an advertisement in the Admiralty Fleet Orders, as they were then, asking for a volunteer instructor to go to the South African Navy for 2 years. I applied, and a large number of people applied. I believe 12 were interviewed at South Africa House in Trafalgar Square, and I got the job.
By this time you were married?
Yes, and my wife went with me.
How had you met your wife?
Well, her family and mine were friendly from the time she was a baby, really. And so I've known her for many years. Anyway, we got married. We went to South Africa. And after about 4 months, I think she'd been homesick probably all the time she was there. She was only 19 anyway. And what with the strange country, I suppose, it was a wonderful country, South Africa, but there were problems there then. And it was decided, partly by her, partly by her mother, and partly in my agreement, reluctant agreement, I might add, that she would return home. So I did the last several months out there on my own.
Were you shore-based during your time with the
South? Yes. Initially, I was based in Durban, and I did about 6 weeks in Durban. I was then teaching South African signalmen and leading signalmen various things. And then out of the blue, I was posted to Johannesburg, stationed on a lake there as the signal instructor for the South African Naval Reserve Base in Johannesburg. That was fine, except that it was teaching sea cadets on a Friday night, I think, and reservists, what they called active citizens force. They all had to undergo training at a certain age, the same as we had national service. They had active citizens force training. I think it was twice a week, two evenings a week. And I had the job of teaching a small number of them what I could in the time available. So three short periods of instruction in signals for about 2 hours, three times a week, was all I had to do with signals. I was responsible for a number of other things. I was made responsible to look after the transport of the base. All the other instructors drove lorries and the vehicles. I didn't drive in those days. They all had cars, yet I was the person made responsible for transport. And I had to, every month, assess from the logbooks the miles per gallon that each vehicle was doing. To say that they were variable is but a mild understatement. And so consequently, having had 7 months in Johannesburg, I thought, this really is not for me. I'll get back to sea. So I applied to go to one of their ships. And I went to HMSAS Transvaal for the rest of my time out there, except for a very brief period when I did 2 weeks on a minesweeper for them. But that was a very, very much happier time because the ship was going to Cape Town, to Mombasa, Dar es Salaam, Mauritius, Diego Suarez, all these places, some of which I'd never been to. Well, most of them. And one place we went to was Prince Edward Island, a place called Marion Island in the Prince Edward Group, which is about 1,200 miles southeast of Cape Town. And I soon learned what the Roaring Forties were all about then, because that was only a small ship. Nevertheless, I did enjoy it on there. But I got away from Johannesburg with the problems that I could foresee problems there. Not only that, I was being taught to drive, and it wasn't a terribly good idea, really, because I failed the first test, because I hadn't been told what to do, you see. I was being taught by the other instructors, and it wasn't a particularly good way to learn. Especially when I shifted one of the lorries on a Friday, I moved it from where it was and failed to stop it in time. And this was a 5-ton vehicle, and it stopped just short of the drill hole, the inner wall. That was another experience, but we won't go into. Fortunately, we had it patched up. But I came back from there, I joined the liner coming back at the end of the time in October 52. I joined the liner in Durban, and when we got to Cape Town, there were hundreds of people on the jetty, all waving and shouting, and they were waving at the visitors coming off the land, obviously. But when they'd all started melting away, there was this big chap, and he was still waving. Bald-headed man, and he had a hat. I suddenly realized that it was the first captain of the Transvaal. He had been promoted to Commodore commanding the South African Navy, and he was billeted based just up the road from the base, where the liner was, and he had come down to say cheerio to me, and he too, believe it or not, asked me if I would come back to the South African Navy when my 12 years was up. Would I come back or have my leave and come back out there? And again I said, no thank you. Thank you, but no thank you. And I met him again in HMS Mercury some years later. It's nice to look back on. So that was the South African Navy. I then went to, I had 2 months leave, I think it was. And when that was over, I joined HMS Illustrious, an aircraft carrier which was employed on flying training, training pilots all around the British island, British Isles, from Lyme Bay down off the south coast, off the coast of South Wales, off Belfast, round the other side to Aberdeen, the Firth of Forth. We went round all around the country training pilots. That was an interesting job. We didn't get a lot of signalling out of it because normally we only had one ship with us and she was rescued tender for any planes that went in the sea. But it was an interesting job watching the planes go off and come back and all that. Very noisy. And it was always good fun to watch because when they, what we used to get from time to time, Dutch squadrons, mainly they were off the channel here or Lyme Bay area, they would come on board. They'd start perhaps with 18 planes or perhaps 20 planes. In no time at all, they'd crashed about half of them. Quite amazing. But that's what the ship was doing. And in fact, Illustrious was the first ship to land a jet aircraft when they first came out. I think it was an attacker jet they landed on for the first time. Always very exciting to watch planes landing on an aircraft carrier when you've not got anything to do. But when you're signalling all the time, it's not funny because you've got the noise and the planes going past everything. But I was on board the Illustrious until 18th of January 55. So that was nearly 2 years. The most exciting time I think we had on the Illustrious was when we took part in a huge exercise called Exercise Mariner. That took place in the autumn. And we were involved with lots of ships then. But by that time I was working in the signal and cryptographic office. I wasn't upstairs where everything was happening. So I got all the pressure of the additional signals, 1,000-odd signals a day. And during Exercise Mariner, one of the things that the ship was assigned to do was to attack, imitation-wise, send planes and all that, to attack a place in Denmark called Aalborg. And I remember the flying was taking place day and night, and the broadcast was going day and night. You couldn't sleep, you couldn't work, you couldn't do anything. And that was the last experience I had of that kind of aircraft carrier. I was glad in the end to leave that. After that, I went back to HMS Drake for 3 months, during which time I qualified with an advanced pass as Civil Defence Light Rescue Instructor for the civilian population if it was ever needed. I've got a certificate to say so, but I've never been called upon to use it. And after that, in March, having left Illustrious on the 18th of January 55, and then on the 3rd of March took my first flight to a naval ship, and I flew to the Persian Gulf, to Bahrain, to become the yeoman of signals on board HMS Flamingo, which was the senior officer's ship out there. So I'd had plenty of experience in working with senior officer's ships, and that was a busy job as well. And 6 months later there, I was promoted to chief yeoman of signals, which I was very pleased about. And although I went out by air, I came back at the end of that commission by sea. But during the time that I was on board that ship, I think we went to every place in the Persian Gulf and along the coast towards Karachi and down the Arabian coast, Oman and all those places. But the Persian Gulf was very, very hot, as you've probably heard, and it's very humid, especially in the summer. So we used to go up to Basra about every 6 weeks for about 4 days. And that was to give the crew a break from the intense heat of the Gulf. To the best of our knowledge, there were only about four air conditioning units in the ship. One was in the officer's mess. One was in the chief petty officer's mess, and that was shared with the petty officers. One was in the sailor's mess, I think. But they didn't keep the mess very cool at all. And it was a disciplinary offence to go through a door and not to clip it behind you. Most ships in peacetime, you go up through the door and leave it open, except some below deck have two clips on them. But there it was actually a disciplinary offence to leave a door open. But during that time, it was a very interesting time in seeing different places and all that. And my memories of Basra, I'm sure they would interest you. I didn't really see anything of Basra as a place. I mean, I remember that part of the world as being full of palm trees and sand and ladies with black veils on, going up and down in barges carrying dates. And all I saw of Basra was berthed at the Royal Air Force jetty at Margill. And just a few yards away was the RAF Sergeant's Mess. And I spent quite a bit of time in there, especially in the evenings. We had some lovely evenings there. And about twice, I think, I went to what they call the Basra Bull Ring, which is a big place where you get all these people watching dancing ladies and all that. But to me, it was a waste of time. But some of them went more often than I did. I think I went twice. But I wasn't at all impressed with Iraq, anything to do with it. The best part about Iraq was the Shatt al-Arab River, with the big river that goes up past Basra. We used to do fishing in there, a lot of fishing. And we had a lad on board, he was from a gypsy family, Monk was his surname. He used to have an earring, the only man in the ship allowed to wear an earring, because he was a gypsy. He used to catch fish like there was no tomorrow. We tried for hours to catch them. We could never catch them, but he caught big ones, you know. Amazing salmon he used to catch. Iraq and Shatt al-Arab salmon. That was from England. I came home on the ship on the 6th of January 1956. And then I was employed as an instructor in Devonport. And the following year, the end of that year, December 57, I then flew to the Far East to join HMS Newfoundland for an 18-month commission. And the first man I saw on the jetty there was the canteen manager of the ship I had just left. That was the second time I served with him. I was later to serve with him in another ship. HMS Newfoundland did a lot of showing of the flag. We went all around Malaya, Hong Kong, Japan. Went to Ceylon, Australia, and then we were returned from Australia, having arrived at one port. We had a schedule there of a cruise of 13 ports of Australia and New Zealand, and the ship was scheduled to go to all of them for a few days at a time. We had no other ships with us, and yet I was kept busy helping with the arranging of people to visit different places. Everywhere wanted a Royal Marine Band. Everywhere wanted to play our first soccer team, hockey team, and everything. The hospitality which was scheduled was quite phenomenal. And I spent the entire time on the way to Australia in helping to arrange this, that, and the other thing.
Through signals.
Yeah, well, this wasn't signals. This was through some were signals, but a lot of it was planning for people to go to these places.